You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Julia, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
My name is Julia Reagan. I'm the founder and CEO of Arcs Lightning. And Arcs Lightning is an end-to-end SaaS platform that helps patients get on specialty medications in a quicker, more affordable way. And we've taken all these paper processes and made them digital. And then we connect the doctor, the patient, and other stakeholders across the patient journey to provide transparency into what's happening. So like we go and order a pizza, we know where it is. But when we need a medication that could be life or death and costs tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars, we are clueless. So Arcs Lightning's created a technology solution to help bring that visibility and transparency to the industry.
Julia, how would you define specialty drug? We don't carry any brand name medicine because of the low reimbursement to pharmacies way below cost. A lot of times I try to be devil's advocate on this show, but this is coming straight from me. I ask you the question, but I have to explain the question. I don't want to set you up to take an arrow. It seems like they're specialty because they're expensive and they don't want pharmacies or whoever else in the pie. And a lot of the insurances through vertical integration kind of keep that part of the pie. Knowing that that is my view, whether it's educated or not, back to my question, how would you define specialty if it's not just expensive?
Yeah, I think that there's multiple different definitions for specialty. How I look at it is, yes, there's a component of high cost, and we're not talking about a couple hundred dollars. We're talking about thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. So cost is one. I think complexity is the other. And the complexity could be around a couple things. It could be the administration complexity of it. It could be the storage complexity of it. You could think of a medicine that only has a 7-day half-life, and then it has to be stored at a certain temperature, and it has to go through a certain process for administration. Anything that requires a lot of education for patients to understand what's going on with the therapy and how it's being used. When we label it, the specialty light medicines is not what we're talking about.
Specialty light, you said?
Yeah, so we're not talking about insulin. We're talking about the cancer medications or the transplant medications or cystic fibrosis, or there's tons of disease states, the biologics that are used for allergy, asthma, derm, GI. All of those things have a lot of complexity to it. And sometimes because of the complexity, it might come from a pharmacy because there's only a small portion of pharmacies that have access to the medication from the manufacturer. Or it might even be a buy and bill drug. And then we got into a whole nother layer of complexity with white bagging and brown bagging and every other type of bagging that exists out there. But those medications that are dual eligible and could go on the pharmacy benefit or the medical benefit based upon where the administration is and how it's being used could also add complexity. So those are the meds that we're talking about. When we look at the market, about 52% of our drug spend makes up these, but it's only about 3% of the volume in the industry today.
Julia, that's exactly the one I'm talking about, where you said only so many pharmacies get that medicine. Is that because the pharmacies that don't get it are incompetent? Why is that? Why can only so many pharmacies get it if it's just not a pricing issue?
Yeah, I think it's more around the drug manufacturer deploying strategies that make sense for them fiscally for distribution. So if we're talking about a rare disease that only has 1,000 patients nationally, does it really make sense to put a $40,000 drug at 100 pharmacies? No, it makes sense to put a $40,000 drug at one pharmacy or two pharmacies and have that be the centralized location to find access and distribution to those 1,000 patients. I think that not all specialty drugs are limited distribution or limited access, depending on how you qualify for them. Some people also mistake limited distribution or limited access for a generics decision around pricing strategy. That's not what this is. It's complex. I'm going to make as a manufacturer distribution decision and also the service decision. Because these medicines cost so much, there needs to be documentation at the payer and at the pharmacy to ensure that all the criteria met for the payer to approve it and pay for the medicine is done up front. Because with a $300 drug, if you go dispense it and then the insurance is not going to pay for it, a pharmacy could eat that cost potentially. And that happens. But when you're talking about a $20, $30, $40, $50, $80,000 drug, a pharmacy can't go eat those costs. So they're going to do everything to make sure that, one, they could dispense it, two, they're in the payer's network, three, the PA criteria or whatever utilization management criteria is satisfied. Four, they've got all the documentation. Five, because the patient's not physically coming in to pay for the medicine, that they've got the payment information from that. And then a lot of times the drug manufacturers and pharmacies have special data sharing agreements together because it's such a small patient population and because it's such a high cost med, they want to make sure that certain data is collected for whatever purposes they need in a more de-identified way. So there's a lot of reasons for it.
Julia, I have an idea. You should start a company that kind of keeps track of all that.
You're a little late.
So that's what you guys are doing. You're taking all of that, all of those things you mentioned. And then also there's the stress in there of someone's dying and all these big decisions. And you're kind of funneling that through your SaaS program and making, as sure as you can, making sure things are efficient, effective, on and on and on.
Correct. We're agnostic to therapy. So we support just under 1,300 medicines. So that's how we label specialty. And the patient journey typically goes through multiple steps. It's the benefits, like, is the insurance going to pay for it? If so, where? How? How much does it cost? And then there's the PA component. And then there's that affordability, financial assistance aspect to it. And then after that, because of the complexity of it, that happens on a reoccurring basis. If the patient needs to stay on therapy, it could happen annually. It could happen semi-annually. Some of these meds happen more frequently depending on different complexities and criteria that exist. So Rx Lightning takes all of those different parts of the process, which are traditionally paper or phone calls, and we make it digital. So offices could go in our system, pick a medication that or medications appropriate for me for treatment and work through that process digitally. And then we take the what used to be fax to a manufacturer or payer or a pharmacy, and we connect pipes to transmit that digitally. So we remove the entire, go find the piece of paper, fill it out, missing information. And then on the back end, that's only the first part of it. On the back end, it's closing that feedback, because when a fax machine is used, you send it off. And then to follow up, what do you have to do? You have to pick up the phone and call. So when we're connected, then we get feedback back, which provides providers information in real time. And then we went a step further because we said, okay, well, for me, if I'm a patient, it's not just good enough to alleviate this for the office, because as a patient, if I need my cancer treatment, I'm going to keep calling the office. So how do we create an experience that the patient also has the same information in an appropriate way, because not all patients are as educated consumers of healthcare as appropriate. So, but how do we get the patient plugged into the equation? And then how do we plug other support individuals across that journey into it as well? Because drug manufacturers have support teams that work with the patients and the providers to help navigate this, as well as the pharmacies. So we have a digital experience for all of those individuals that could really see what's going on to help them mitigate any potential barriers that occur, all while having full like CRM, customer relationship, like tracking functionality that they could document what's happening.
Your marketing says we hate faxes. Medicine seems so far behind other industries. Why is that? I'm thinking it's all for negative reasons. Do they have reasons for this? It just seems archaic.
Well, before there wasn't a solution, right? So if you had a piece of paper that you had to fill out and you printed it and filled it out, and there's a fax number, you've got to go fax it. If there's not another option, you don't have another option. So for Arx Lightning, it's now giving people an option. And like, we still have organizations that we're trying to convince, like, get off the fax machine. The fax machine actually introduces more potential for HIPAA compliance issues, especially post-COVID when you have staff members working from home because they're no longer in the office and they're receiving fax communications from a pharmacy about a patient and they're in their house. Like, there's an opportunity for HIPAA to be exposed. Whereas a technology platform where there's login and everything's secure, you remove those burdens completely.
So, Julia, you named all of these players, and I think I saw on your website, I think it's the doctor's offices don't pay you anything. What's your revenue stream?
Yeah, so our main revenue stream is the drug manufacturers. So while we support 1,300 medications and we remove the paper out of the equation for the doctors, we don't have the feedback loop that closes when we're working with manufacturers. So by working with the manufacturer, we look at the patient journey, and each patient journey is the same, but every drug has different barriers across that patient journey that could impact access and affordability. So we work with the drug manufacturers and really say, what are the pain points across this journey for your patients and your providers? And then we take our technology and ensure that when those pain points occur, we're connecting all of the individuals, because there's people that traditionally navigate these manually. So we're connecting them with the technology, either passively or actively, to try to inform them to do the next best thing. So if you think about a patient, if there's not an issue to treatment, well, I, as the manufacturer, the pharmacy rep, would want to be informed, but I don't necessarily need to take action on that. But if I know that there's a barrier that is going to prevent the patient from getting their treatment next month, that is when I want to take action. So we work with the drug manufacturers and the pharmacies. They license our technology, and we, with the appropriate consents and information across the journey, we're able to connect them in a digital way with both the patient and the providers to navigate and alleviate these barriers that exist while creating a better experience.
So they're buying this software. Like you said, you're agnostic to these medicines. They're not paying you for the certain medicines. They're just paying you to use your software.
Yeah. So we support the 1,300 medicines, and they're not all sponsored, obviously, but we still create for the doctors and the offices an experience that is much better than paper, because when paper's used, they're keeping track of the outcomes of paper on Excel or Post-it or something even scarier than Post-its, which we've all seen. So we've created a tool that is extremely efficient and helps for the office. But then we work with the drug manufacturers and the pharmacies to really create a unique experience to make it even easier and provide more information than they would have by just removing paper out of the equation.
So there's some manufacturers that don't officially get your software, but you still represent the drug because you want to have a full library of the medicines that are out there.
Correct. Yeah. So the office is... it's very helpful for the offices because they don't have to go look up the forms or find the forms or find the next step of the process. And then it's always interesting. Manufacturers, when we talk to them, they're like, well, if it's already there, why do we have to work with you? And it's like, well, just because it's there doesn't mean it's actually set up appropriately to be very effective for you. And you're missing out on the ability to create a interconnected ecosystem to really take your services that are traditionally people-based from call centers into the 21st century to engage with both your providers and your patients in a way that you couldn't engage with them before.
When you say manufacturers already have this, they might already have a manual or a on-computer database or call centers, you're saying that's all fine, but your thing will actually integrate all those together on the program.
Yeah. So the drug manufacturers typically have their hub services, which is a big call center that's receiving faxes and then making phone calls out and sending faxes out. Just very inefficient, very costly. They also have their field reimbursement teams or nurse navigators that are calling doctors, working with the doctors, working with the patients. And traditionally, they're working off of the data that's coming from the specialty pharmacy or the hub. But those are dependent on data feeds. So it's usually stagnant. It's not real time. And they're putting these great people and programs into market to be used. But because everything's delayed, because paper and faxes are used and there's a ton of missing information, it just is not as effective. So it creates delays to getting a patient on therapy. With our platform, we help alleviate that with the appropriate patient consents, et cetera, to provide transparency right from the beginning and then intervention. So we make their services that exist today and their people that exist today just more effective and efficient with technology to be able to touch more patients than they would have without us.
Is there ever anybody in that group of, let's say, the four or five stakeholders in this that do it? Is there ever one that is behind the times that will be out of that loop if they don't jump on the program? Are there hospitals or manufacturers that if they don't come along with the current age of a program like yours that they can't play ball anymore, or they still do it, but it roughs the system up because you still have the faxes and things like that?
Yeah, I think on the provider side, yeah, there's doctors that won't adopt technology. There's doctors that haven't adopted the EHRs that have been around for the last 20 years because they've resisted it. So I think that you'll have those. I don't think it necessarily impacts us. If providers traditionally won't get into new modern age technology, they're probably not getting into new modern age medicines either.
That makes sense.
That's one aspect. On the manufacturer side, the drug manufacturers are looking to improve their patient services. They're looking to create better processes and efficiencies and be able to support their patients in new ways. And I think that the status quo of paper, phone calls, faxing, and these large call centers that are just really costly is something that the entire industry is pushing to make more efficient. And Arcs Lightning does that. We place Switzerland in the place, so we do not try to replace them or remove them out of the experience. We just connect in, which makes them more efficient, which makes the manufacturer happy. And it's kind of a win-win for everybody involved.
Call centers and things like that. Are they hub for many different manufacturers? Is there a service, or does each manufacturer, if they have one, it's their own?
So it's kind of twofold. A hub could be internal, which is more the trend of pharma, where they're bringing them internally, which in those scenarios, it is a perfect partnership because we could do the technology and feed in and just make them extremely more efficient. And the reason why they're insourcing is for those efficiencies because of the cost. For the external hubs, some of these medicines truly do need people making phone calls to the payers. So we just make them more efficient. And in those situations, we get them data upfront on intake to replace multiple steps across the process that just takes time. That actually then allows them to do what they were hired to do more effectively, which in turn provides better services for their client, which is their manufacturer, and therefore gives them better outcomes for the patients. So I think that if you really took the layer beyond the obvious out and stepped back and said, okay, they can help us. I mentioned earlier, we place Switzerland in the process because these call centers could exist at the specialty pharmacy. They could exist at a hub. They could exist in a health system. Arcs Lightning is plugging into all of that, trying to make efficiencies and really saying, look, we want to use technology. We don't want to be the people part of the process. We want to use technology to create efficiencies and to give information that traditionally lives in a documentation center to the people that actually could engage with it and do something with it that would prevent a patient from getting on therapy or staying on therapy, depending on where they are in their life cycle of treatment. One of the reasons why an organization like Arcs Lightning could happen is because other companies stopped innovating and didn't take their platforms to the next level to do this. Like, Arcs Lightning should not be involved. There's a lot of players that could have done and approached the market like we've done. So for me, as the leader of Arcs Lightning, what I'm trying to always do is push us forward. There's always going to be a new medicine that comes out that might have a unique piece of the problem that we could continue to innovate on. And then we could take that to a medicine that could benefit that's already on our platform. So I think for us, when we're looking at an ecosystem and really being that connective tissue between the doctor, the patient, the payer, the pharmacy, the drug manufacturer, really gives Arcs Lightning a very unique opportunity in the future to take that network and to take that inner ecosystem and interconnectivity and engagement and really change how healthcare is done. So I don't see us ever not innovating.
There's a lot of companies that, oh, hell, who am I kidding? I'm one myself in my pharmacy. I've just got a limited number of years left, and I'm not innovating and thinking like I would have maybe 15, 20 years. And my business is going to suffer from it, but I'll be dead by the time it suffers that much. But a lot of companies have died. They just haven't innovated. Julie, are you happy with your growth?
Look, innovation and disruption takes time. Arcs Lightning is a very young company. We incorporated right before the pandemic. So we are just 3 years old. Our product hasn't even been in market for 3 years. It's been in just about a little over 2 years. And we have some of the largest healthcare systems in the nation using us. We have some of the largest drug manufacturers partnered with us. And what we're really seeing is that things that used to take weeks just to fill out a piece of paper is taking less than an hour. And we're then seeing, as a result of that, patients getting on therapy much, much quicker. So patients are actually able to start their treatment before the piece of paper would have been completed to just submit wherever it needed to be submitted on. And as a result, we keep our platform very simple, very repeatable, very user-friendly. And because of that, the offices have seen what the capabilities are and the transformation that it happens. And we're growing at rates that sometimes is really hard to keep up with as a two-year-old company. So we have some of the other problems of how do we continue to do what we need to do to change the industry while hiring the best people that could move at fast rates, because the demand is there for us to continue to deliver. So it's a very challenging and rewarding growth phase that we're in.
What was your proof of concept in getting this? How did you know, or did you know this was going to go before you invested into the software?
Yeah. Well, luckily, I think my career and my personal experience has put me into the position to know. I knew that answer before I started the company. I'm not a risky person naturally, so I don't think I would have ever started a company just to start a company on a whim. We talked about the patient journey and multiple parts of that process. So for the last 15 years, I've really innovated in that, in a lot of industry firsts around the pricing and the coverage and the PA I helped bring to the industry. And simultaneous to that, I had a personal experience that occurred where I, as an educated consumer of healthcare, had challenges to navigate. And if I had challenges to navigate, what would a consumer of healthcare that didn't intimately know those processes, how would they be able to navigate them and be impacted? So when I started Arcs Lightning, I had all the career experience and then innovation experience to know that specialty was going to be a huge market in the next couple of years and how to solve it. And then I had the personal experience that said, this is how we're going to solve it differently, because everybody else is isolated thinking about one drug or one part of the process. And we're going to build this entire ecosystem and connect people together. And it is a big feat. And people, I think, probably thought I was crazy initially, like, you're going to do too much. You're not going to be able to do that. But luckily, I had an amazing co-founder who he and I worked together at previous organizations. And he's a brilliant technologist. And he was able to build my crazy vision and been we layered the team on, and who most of our early team members were with us at other organizations. So we had a great foundation from the beginning. And fortunately for us, it did take off. And now we have really elevated our game, bringing our last round of capital in to the organization. And the thought leadership that we brought in with that capital raise is really taking us to kind of new heights and new opportunities. Not saying that it won't be challenging, because this next phase of growth is just as challenging as the first, but it will be fun and we'll have the people around the table to help us navigate it.
You talk about the different companies, and I saw on LinkedIn the history of your employment and so on. Was physical geographical location important to any of that? I know back in the 80s, you'd hear about Silicon Valley. You wanted to be there to rub elbows with everybody. Then you talked about some people you brought on and so on. Has the internet diminished that geographic need? Are you picking these talents up from all over, or was there any kind of a geography involved where you were all in a certain city or things like that?
Well, remember, we were born in January of 2020. So we basically said, hey, I got this crazy idea. I'm going to leave my full-time job and start this company. And I'm going to bring my co-founder and start this company. And then the world shut down and nobody left their houses for God knows how long. I try not to go back and remember how long. But so we built the initial company completely remote. It was 100% remote. We actually are just moved into headquarters in Southern Indiana outside of Louisville, Kentucky, in New Albany, I think April 15th-ish. And we haven't even officially opened our office publicly. That's happening later this month. So now we are intentionally hiring locally. There are some roles we are asking to relocate. Other roles we're saying do not need to relocate, and we will find the best people depending on what they are. So I think for me, for years, I've always operated remotely. Even before Arcs Lightning started, I was a remote employee for most of my career. So you could accomplish great things in a remote environment. There's also something being said about being in a location and being able to, at this pace and the speed, work together and whiteboard and come together. So we're culturally saying, like, we want a combination of it, and we'll see the growth there. We've recently worked with the Indiana Economic Development to get incentives to recruit locally and in the a couple states that surround us. So we're being more intentional about that. But in order for Arcs Lightning to really disrupt the industry and change this for patients and providers and help make sure that everyone has access to their medicines quickly and affordably, we need to move at a pace that we may not be able to be confounded by the local region.
Where do you interact with other people like yourself, other entrepreneurs, other leaders? Is this only at conferences? Once in a while, you hear like two companies like you have merged or something like that. Where would you even see these people now or get acquainted with them?
So I think in healthcare, just general company, BD, M&A type of stuff is through network conferences, through our investors. They're just watching the market. I think on the other hand of that, from an entrepreneur perspective, and there's multiple networks. So I've been fortunate to be selected into the Endeavor Network, which is an international network. They're not just in healthcare. They really are trying to bring that Silicon Valley experience to markets that aren't Silicon Valley. So there's a local tri-state area one, but it's an international. And through that, I've actually met a ton of high growth founders that are in my industry and outside my industry that help me from an entrepreneur perspective. But I've also been very fortunate that some of them, their businesses and my business have synergies.
Julia, what was your thought the first time you came across ChatGPT? What bells went off in your head with regards to your company?
Do you want my honest answer?
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was first. I was like, does that really exist?
Well, who would know what it was? Everything's new at some point.
So that was my first reaction. afterwards, I think it's great. Like the fact that it could aggregate data and put positioning together is phenomenal. So my COO and I talk about it all the time, like being able to put social media in and get a couple options and look at what that is like versus what a human created social media post is like. It just makes us more efficient. So I'm interested to see how ChatGPT grows and impacts more industries, and then what other companies will move into that as a secondary. ChatGPT has a lot in front of them to stay as the leader in that space. So,
Julia, what is the worst hour of your week where you wake up and you're like, crap, I got to do this morning? What is that hour, if you have one?
Oh, it's probably around 3 a.m. I usually wake up around 3 a.m. most days, and just something's on my mind. And it's like, I either get up and go deal with it, or I fall back to sleep in 10 minutes. I usually thank God the days I fall back to sleep. I think as a founder, there's just always something to be done. I never have a clean inbox. I never have no to-dos. Usually they're large to-dos. I usually am not interacting or engaging with things that are going well in the organization either. I'm working on the growth and the vision or the stuff that really needs my attention. And that's always fun. And because of it, it usually something will be on my mind when I go to bed and it'll wake me up. I try to go back to sleep, though.
I think you're in a good position, or you were in a good position from the start, because you knew you were in a company that you brought on, and it was pretty sure that you thought it might grow fast, versus somebody who maybe fell into a business through nepotism or maybe raised up the ranks and didn't quite know the pressure of that. But a founder, you're jumping in right away into that. So you better have the skills from like day one, or it's going to go belly up right away.
Industry statistics don't lie. How many organizations get to their Series A? Arcs Lightning is in a class that not many companies get to. Every stage is challenging, but those early stages of raising initial capital, putting the business together, finding your first clients, those are sometimes the ones that, or the moments that could break people, because usually you're isolated and alone or with a co-founder doing that. You're not normally having a network and a support system. Fortunately for us, as we've grown, we've got amazing investors and mentors and advisors around us that when I need something, I just go talk to them and have a pretty transparent conversation. And they've done it before. So I take the guidance that I really like and I implement it. And I didn't like it, I just kind of move on.
Julia, would you have done investors and all that stuff if you didn't need to?
I think investors are wonderful. I also am really spoiled with my investors because they have been there for anything that I've needed. 100% ownership of an organization that grows really small versus less ownership that's growing to be a substantially larger number and having an impact are very different journeys. And I think it's up to the founder and the type of business it is. I don't think every business should be a venture capital invested business and go out and do high growth, raise the capital, because they're never going to step into the potential of that. For me, our investors are some of the top investors internationally in healthcare. So being able to not just have the capital to support our growth, but to be able to pick up the phone and talk to them about anything strategic that I need help or guidance on, or test a thought that I have, and is my gut instinct right? Or even just tapping into their networks from a staffing and talent perspective is worth bringing additional capital on and worth having the dilution. But I think it's very personal to founders.
Was there any doubt when you started this with the other founder? Was there any doubt that this would be the road you'd take? You knew it was going to be investment rounds and all that kind of stuff, or not?
No, we knew we were raising capital. We self-funded for about 9 months. But as soon as we needed to hire individuals, he and I were successful in our careers, but we didn't have capital to just invest millions of dollars into the company. So we needed to raise capital. So we went out for our first round, I guess, 10 months after we incorporated. And then we've been very fortunate from there. We did our seed round basically 14 months after our incorporation, and we just closed our Series A last week.
So. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're very excited.
Julia, somebody shoves you up on stage at a commencement of a college, and they're like, Julia, you got to say like 30 seconds to these new graduates. What's your message to them?
That is a good question. I think that the biggest thing is you've got to kind of push boundaries. Be yourself and push boundaries. We work a lot. Every day we work so much. We spend more time working than we do with our families. And you got to find something you love, because then work isn't work. I love what I'm doing. I love leading this company. I love the mission and the vision and the team that's behind me. And it's not work. We are doing something which I hope one day will be remarkable and impactful for the healthcare industry. So I would tell people to find that, find whatever that is, and grab a hold of it and do whatever you need to do to make it successful while also keeping in the forefront what life is really about, which is your friends and your family and, you know, the other things. I have two kids. I have an 11-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son. And for me, like, yes, I want RX Lightning to make impact, but I also want to demonstrate to the kids that if they put their mind to doing something, whatever it is, if it's in healthcare or if it's fashion or art or anything that they want, they could do it if they enjoy it and believe in it and put the work into it. So that would be my commencement speech, something like that.
Well, Julia, boy, what I like about your message is we pharmacists, we love to bitch about stuff. We just love to bitch about stuff. However, if we can look the other direction, there's a million needs that have to be done in this industry. Everything from better care to the stuff that you're doing, bringing people together, whatever problem you're solving. And so there's just so much out there, so many opportunities for entrepreneurs. And so thanks for giving us that example.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come hang out with you today. And to all your listeners, I think that there are so many smart people out there that have worked and have great career experience. And there's so many things that we could do to change the industry. And if they have an idea, they should go after it and go do it.
Good advice. All right, Julia, thanks. We'll be in touch.
Okay, talk soon.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.